Welcome to Radioactive Magazine. We will be talking with Ambassador William B. Taylor, Jr., the Vice President for Russia and Europe of the U.S. Institute of Peace, USIP, about his work there and about the current Russo-Ukraine war. Ambassador Taylor is a West Point graduate with 6 years in the U.S. Army, including 18 months in Vietnam. He has a master's in public policy from Harvard and decades of public service in various roles. This included service in the Department of Energy, the Office of Management and Budget, the Council of Economic Advisors, and the State Department. The latter included service in Iraq and Israel-Palestine before being named the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine from 2006 to 2009 under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. I'm Spencer Graves. Carl Brooks will help with this interview.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here with you and Carl. In addition to serving as U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine in 2006-2009, as you correctly said, the government called me back to go back out to Ukraine as Chargé d'Affaires, which is essentially the acting ambassador, in 2019 and early 2020. Mm-hmm. So I had the honor of serving as U.S. Ambassador twice in Ukraine. And I'm very pleased to be able to be talking with you and Carl about it here today.
So what are the most important things about that you would like to communicate to our listeners?
The most important thing to communicate about this war is that we have a lot at stake. This war started, of course, with the Russians invading Ukraine in 2014, and then again in 2022 in what we call kind of the full-fledged, the major invasion of Ukraine by the Russians in 2022. But it's not just the Russian invasion of Ukraine that's at stake here. What's at stake for the United States and for people that are interested in these issues, which should be all of us, is that Ukraine is fighting the Russians to defend Europe and to defend us. The Ukrainians are trying to stop the Russians in Ukraine and to push the Russians back out of Ukraine. And if they fail, if we let them fail, if the United States and the rest of NATO lets Ukraine fail, then we are at risk. We are vulnerable. The Russians then are right on the long border of NATO, right up against the Poles. We, the United States, we have security interests, economic interests, social interests, political interests in Europe. And that's why we're in NATO. And that's why we're there to defend the Poles. And the threat to the Poles and the Baltic states from Russia, if it is allowed to win, if it's allowed to win against Ukraine, is a threat to us. We'll be involved, and it will be a very bad situation in the United States, in the world, if the Russians are able to defeat the Ukrainians who are trying to defend themselves and their young democracy against this autocracy, against this dictator who is trying to eliminate Ukraine. And if he eliminates Ukraine, that's a message to the whole world that big nations now can invade small nations and get away with it. That big nations can grab parts of their neighbor and get away with it. And that's not a world that Americans want to live in, that Europeans want to live in, that Africans want to live in, that South Americans want. That's not a world we want to live in. We would rather live in a world where big nations don't invade their neighbors.
Right. So I was talking a few weeks ago with a guy who claimed he'd been in the Crimea, and he said that the Russian-speaking part of Ukraine really all wanted to be part of Russia. Your comment.
So in 1991, when the Soviet Union disappeared, imploded, actually just before the Soviet Union imploded, there was a referendum in Ukraine and in other parts of the Soviet Union as well. But in Ukraine, there was a referendum about asking Ukrainians if they wanted to stay part of the Soviet Union, essentially under Russia. And in every part of Ukraine, including Crimea, including the south, including the east, including what we now call Donbas, that is Donetsk and Luhansk, all of these places that, yes, a lot of people in those parts of Ukraine did speak Russian. That does not make them Russian. Let's make that very clear. They're Ukrainians. They happen to speak Russian. So every part of Ukraine voted to leave the Soviet Union. And when they vote every time, when they vote again on in presidential elections, they vote as well to maintain their independence.
Talk about the risks of escalation of transferring not just artillery shells and short-range surface-to-air and surface-to-surface missiles, but F-16s and intermediate-range ballistic missiles or drones that could attack Moscow.
There's no escalation possible. The Russians are at the top of their game. With the exception, of course, of nuclear weapons, which they are not going to use, in most people's view. The Russians have thrown everything they have into this. There's nothing more for them to escalate. I just mentioned in answer to Carl's question that the Russians are looking to throw more soldiers, which is what they've been doing. That's why I say they can't escalate further. They've been just throwing soldiers into this fight. And losing an incredible number of Russian soldiers, but that doesn't stop them. They are at the top of their effort. So there's nothing more to escalate. Now, some people have asked about the nuclear. The Russians are not going to. You made the point, Spencer, when the Russians have said, "Oh my gosh, you guys better not provide F-16s, or you better not provide long-range artillery." Or else we might, we might escalate. Well, they haven't. We've provided those every time, and nothing has happened. So, and one of the reasons that the two reasons that the Russians haven't escalated, one is that they know what happens if they use nuclear weapons, a tactical nuclear weapon in Ukraine. Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor to President Biden, has said very clearly that there will be catastrophic consequences for the Russians, not a nuclear catastrophic consequence, but a conventional catastrophic consequence for the Russian military if they were to use a tactical nuclear. So that's deterrence. That's the deterrence. They're deterred. But second, the Chinese, who call the shots now for the Russians. So let's just be clear. The Russians are the little brothers to the Chinese these days. The Chinese are the powerful, and the Russians are beholden to the Chinese. They chafe at this, but nonetheless, that's the situation. The Chinese have told the Russians, shut up about the use of nuclear weapons. Don't even talk about it, much less even consider using it. So the Russians have kind of backed down on that. So I think that there is no worry about further escalation because the Russians are already escalated to the top of their conventional capability.
So
Ambassador.
we are visiting with Ambassador William B. Taylor Jr., the Vice President for Russia and Europe at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Carl?
Ambassador, the recent strikes by Russians on the Ukrainian power grid appear to be direct efforts to attack civilian populations. From the standpoint of the U.S. Institute of Peace, does this represent a new phase of the conflict or a new risk to the way the conflict is going to turn out that there are these direct attacks on civilian facilities?
Sadly, Carl, this is not new. The Russians have been attacking civilian infrastructure since the beginning of this war. Last winter, they attacked nuclear electricity, well, nuclear power plants, but also electricity from thermal conventional nuclear power plants, conventional power plants burning coal or natural gas, and the transmission facilities the Russians targeted, so that the Ukrainians were out of electricity for long periods of time last winter. They are back at the Russians are back at it. The Russians are attacking again thermal nuclear power plants. They are occupied the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. They are attacking coal fire plants. The Russians are trying to batter the Ukrainians into submission. The Ukrainians are a tough people, and they've endured a lot. Most people, when they saw this war starting, gave the Ukrainians no chance of holding out against the Russians. The Russian military was thought to be unstoppable, and the Ukrainians stopped it. And the Ukrainians have been fighting them to a standstill for 2 years.
Deterrence expert Richard Ned Lebow and others have documented and claimed that deterrence strategies have historically been as likely to provoke as prevent undesired behaviors. Your comment?
So it turns out deterrence has stopped the first the Soviet Union and next the Russians from invading or even threatening to invade NATO nations. This is what deterrence does. Deterrence through NATO, and this is both conventional as well as nuclear. I mean, the Russians know, and the Soviets before them knew. That they could never win a war that they would start against the NATO nation. And that's deterrence. The Russians thought that they could take over Ukraine because Ukraine couldn't defend itself. That's what they thought. Turns out the Russians were wrong. The Ukrainians have defended themselves valiantly, amazingly. I disagree. I think deterrence plays a big role here in stopping wars.
Ambassador, staying for a moment on this topic of NATO, do you detect any uneasiness on the part of certain nations in NATO for the direction that this conflict is going? For example, the French President Macron seems to have indicated that he's uneasy in some respects with coalition strategy, and it's possible France may have to, in some way, go it alone.
So I haven't heard the French or President Macron talk about going it alone. I have, but however, I have heard worries on the part of French and other Europeans that the United States could be losing its will to participate fully in NATO. And if the United States does not fully back the commitments, the NATO commitments, then the Europeans worry about that because they count on our support. They count on our military support, our political support, our leadership in NATO. The Europeans, sometimes don't like it very much, but they really, when there's a possibility that the American leadership could be withdrawn, they make it very clear that they need the American leadership in NATO.
Do you have any thoughts on the prospects for something like the 1953 Korean Armistice Agreement that could end this conflict?
So when you ask the Ukrainians if they're prepared to give up 20% of their territory, like in the Korean Armistice model example, the Ukrainians say no. The Ukrainians say they're not ready to give up 20% of their land, primarily because they'd be giving up 20% of their people, of Ukrainian citizens. And the Ukrainians know what happens when the Russians occupy Ukrainian territory. When the Ukrainians know what happens when the Russians occupy Ukrainian cities. When the Russians temporarily occupied some cities, towns north of Kyiv in the first part of this war, they were there for about a month, the Russians. And then the Ukrainians pushed them back out, liberated those cities, deoccupied those cities. And what the Ukrainians found in those cities when they pushed the Russians out was horrible. Was horrible. There were mass graves. There was torture, there were rapes, There were children that were stolen and sent back to Russia. It was war crimes, atrocities, that the Ukrainians are not ready to allow happen again, and leave some Ukrainian cities and citizens under Russian occupation. They're not ready to do that. So that's what it would, that's what they would say about the North Korea solution.
So, Ambassador, you mentioned war crimes, which raises a question of law and especially international law. From the standpoint of USIP and your own experience, where do you see international law having any impact or any effect on the outcome of this conflict? Have we moved past a legal resolution? Is it simply now going to be fought out on the battlefield with legal consequences to be dealt with downrange later?
Oh, this is a hard one. This is a hard one. There is no doubt that the Russian shredding of international law, the Russian rejection of the commitments, the treaties that they have signed, that the charter, the UN charter, which the Soviets and the Russians have signed, which embedded in the charter. And in a lot of these treaties, most of the treaties that the Russians have signed with even the Ukrainians calls for the respect for sovereignty of all nations. That's a international principle in the law, in the UN charter, in UN in Ukrainian Russian treaties. Respect for sovereignty is there, in that international law. Respect for borders. That is, you don't invade, you don't cross borders. You don't violate borders. So the Russians have shredded those laws. And sadly, the way that that is going to be resolved is by the Ukrainians winning this war against the Russians. The Ukrainians are going to have to push the Russians out of their country to reestablish their sovereign territory. This is another reason. That's a more abstract reason, but it's no less real. Another reason that the Ukrainians have to win this war to reestablish international law, respect for sovereignty, borders. The International Criminal Court has indicted Vladimir Putin for war crimes. In particular, I mentioned the abduction of Ukrainian children back into Russia, trying to make them Russian kids. That's a war crime. And the International Criminal Court has indicted Vladimir Putin for that crime. Can that be enforced? No, only if the Ukrainians win. If the Ukrainians win, then there's a chance that that international law can be reestablished.
Carl?
Ambassador, I'm curious about your impressions of Ukrainian leadership during this period. You've had probably more up close experiences with those who are responsible for making decisions in Ukraine than most anybody in the United States. Do you see weaknesses as well as strengths in the leadership of Ukraine right now? Or do you see across the board that they're doing exactly what they need to do in this situation?
So, Carl, the Ukrainians have, you're exactly right. They have shown incredible courage, in particular the leadership, and in particular President Zelensky. Let's just be clear. We all remember in the early grim days of this war, the Americans and others, when they saw the Russians bearing down on Kyiv, on the capital, where Zelensky was, the Russians were right on the outskirts. The Russian tanks were right on the outskirts of Kyiv, the capital. And there were assassination squads, Russian assassination squads in the city looking for Zelensky in order to take him out so that the Russians could take over the country. And the Americans and others offered to Zelensky to take him out of Kyiv, to remove him, to keep him safe, and to move him into either a safer part of Ukraine in the Carpathians down the southwest, or even into, say, Poland. To protect him so that he can continue to lead his troops. And we remember the courage that he showed He said famously, "I need ammunition, not a ride." And he stayed in Ukraine. He stayed in Kyiv. He stayed in his office. And he was out on the streets with a camera showing his people where he was. I mean, the people of Ukraine knew exactly what his office looked like. It's a very distinctive office. And he took a picture of himself, a video of himself in front of that office showing Ukrainian people that he's not leaving. He's right there. He's with them. And the soldiers were really impressed by this. Now, so that's the courage and the strength of that leadership.
Change of pace. Would you care to comment on what you think are the most important accomplishments of the U.S. Institute of Peace since its founding in 1984?
Sure. So the Institute of Peace, indeed, as you say, it was founded in 1984 during the Cold War, let's just remember. And it has established in the early days, early parts of probably the first decade of its existence in the 80s and 90s, it established parts of universities that focused on conflict and resolving conflict, peace studies in various universities. You all probably know something about that, the University of Kansas and related universities around the country. Now have curricula that look at conflict resolution, look at ways to resolve wars and conflict that is now well established as an academic focus. That was an early success on the part of the Institute of Peace. Later on, during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, we established offices in Kabul and in Baghdad, and we helped resolve conflicts there, some internal conflicts, not the conflict in the United States against the Taliban or the United States against ISIS in Iraq. As the United States military was fighting ISIS in Baghdad, just for example, and in Iraq, the US military asked the Institute of Peace, and again, we had an office there, they asked us to help them deal with some of the conflict within Iraqi forces. As we know, the Iraqi society has Sunni and Shia Muslim and tribes, and in some cases, the Muslim and Shia tribes don't get along. And that made it more difficult for our military to fight against ISIS. So they asked us to help them, to help the US military in resolving conflict among Sunni and Shia tribes, which we did, and had some success on that. More recently, we are doing some work on when we could actually talk to the Russians, we would actually sit down with the Russians and talk about arms control unofficially. You know, so we would have conversations with the Russians about arms control before they invaded Ukraine big time in 2022. Those are some of the things, Spencer, that we've been doing.
Ambassador, following up briefly on that, Americans may be surprised to know that we even have a United States Institute of Peace. We're used to thinking of the Department of Defense and so forth. If you were to make the case for a more prominent role for USIP, a seat at the table whenever issues are discussed involving peace and security, what's the best argument for USIP to be at that table?
Great question, Carl. So, and we've had that conversation. You won't be surprised. We've had that conversation among ourselves as well. But how can we best help? I've mentioned in my answer to your earlier question, I've mentioned some of the things that we do kind of in parallel with the U.S. government or the U.S. military to help in conflict resolution or coming up with ideas, solutions, proposals that would help resolve with conflict. There have been suggestions by a previous member of our staff who was actually a former ambassador, and he made exactly this case. He said, you know, the Institute of Peace should really take the next step, and the US government should ask the Institute of Peace to focus on and take responsibility for a conflict that is ongoing in the world somewhere. And wouldn't be a big, it wouldn't be the main, it wouldn't be the Ukraine-Russia one. It wouldn't be Israel-Palestine. It wouldn't be that, that not at that level. But this former ambassador suggested that the United States institutions could have a role in one of these smaller conflicts and demonstrate the benefit. That's going to be hard for the U.S. government has a responsibility to do that. And even though we are funded by the Congress, and we're kind of part of the government, we're not part of the administration. We're independent administration, funded by the Congress. Our board is nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, but it has to be half Republican and half Democrat. So it's a bipartisan, nonpartisan board and nonpartisan institute that does this. But the administration does have responsibility for all of these wars and all of these conflicts that they are involved in. So I think we can continue to help in those, which is what we're trying to do right now.
We are basically out of time, Mr. Ambassador. Any final comments for our listeners?
Thank you, Spencer. First of all, thank you very much for having me. It's a great opportunity to talk with you guys, you, Carl, and Spencer, but also to talk through you to your listeners. I want to come back to where I started, and that is the United States has a leadership role in this world. And if the Russians are allowed to defeat the Ukrainians with our leadership in NATO at stake, we will be much weaker in the world. The United States will be much weaker in the world if we don't support the Ukrainians in their fight against the Russians.
We have been talking with Ambassador William B. Taylor, Jr., the Vice President for Russia and Europe of the U.S. Institute of Peace, USIP, about the Russo-Ukraine War and the U.S. Institute of Peace more generally. Tune in next week to hear Mubarak Awad and Michael Beer, founder and director, respectively, of Nonviolence International, discuss their organization and events featuring Mubarak May 4, Saturday, 2 to 4 p.m., and May 5, Sunday, 10:30 to 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut Street, Kansas City, Missouri. I'm Spencer Graves. Carl Brooks has helped with this interview. Thank you for listening.